Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the second bidder information webcast relating to the 2025 statewide auction process for the procurement of New Jersey's Basic Generation Service, or BGS load. My name is Paul Cardona, and presenting with me today is Rachel Northcutt. We are from NERA, the BGS auction manager. We will answer any questions you have regarding this webcast at the end of the presentation. To ask questions, please locate the Q&A on the right-hand side of your screen. Select all panelists in the ask box, type in your question, and then click send to submit your question. And before getting into the presentation, I'd like to read a quick disclaimer that any statements herein describing or referring to documents and agreements are summaries only and are qualified in their entirety by our reference to such governing documents posted to the BGS auction website, which is www.bgs-auction.com. These documents include the board's order and BPU docket ER24030191, dated November 21, 2024, the BGS CIEP and BGS RACP auction rules, the BGS CIEP and BGS RACP supplier master agreements, as well as each EDC's company specific addendum, including draft tariff sheets and pricing factors. The EDCs will be making a compliance filing by Thursday, December 5th, 2024. These documents will be posted to the BGS auction website. An announcement about their posting will be sent to website registrants. Today, we'll discuss roles, give a broad overview of the board's decision relating to the EDC's proposal, discuss the supplier master agreements, or also known as the SMAs, give a timeline of the auction process, discuss the BGS auction website, as well as the application process and the auction rules. Lastly, we'll provide a brief overview of the bidding procedures. There are well-defined roles for the auction manager, the EDCs, the board, and the board's consultant. The EDCs, that is to say PSE&G, JCP&L, ACE, and RICO are responsible for elements of the proposal. The auction manager is responsible for carrying out auction promotional efforts, communicating information, organizing responses to bidder questions, and administering the auction in accordance with the auction rules as approved by the board. Board staff and the board's consultant are consulted on all the auction parameters. The board's consultant monitors the conduct of the auctions and briefs the board during the auction process. The board monitors the auctions, reviews, and renders a decision on the final auction results. Finally, the decision on the auction results occurs within 2 business days after the close of the BGS CIP RCP auction, whichever comes later. The next section deals with the board decision, and before getting into the board decision, I'll briefly review events prior to that time. The regulatory proceeding began when, in April 2024, the board issued an order asking the EDCs and any other party to submit a proposal to procure supply for New Jersey's BGS customers. The EDC submitted their proposal, which was followed by a regulatory proceeding that included discovery, 2 rounds of written comments, as well as a legislative type hearing. The board rendered its decision on the EDC's proposal at its regular agenda meeting on November 21st, 2024. The board's decision is memorialized through a board order that's available on the BGS auction website, which again is www.bgs-auction.com. The board decision maintained the building blocks from past auctions. There will be 2 statewide clock auctions where the prices tick down as long as there are more tranches bid than are needed. The statewide process means that the 2 auction processes happen in tandem. The first of the 2 auctions is the BGS CIP auction, which will procure supply for larger commercial and industrial customers over a 1-year supply period. The second auction is the BGS RACP auction, which will procure supply for residential and smaller commercial customers over a 3-year supply period. The board decision also approved the consideration of results within 2 business days of the close of the BGS CIP auction or the close of the BGS RACP auction, whichever happens last. I'll next talk about certain elements of the EDC's proposal at a general level, highlighting a couple of items important for bidders. So first, since the 2020 BGS proceeding, the board approved the use of capacity proxy prices as the actual capacity prices for some energy years in the supply period were not known prior to those auctions. the use of capacity proxy prices ensured that the BGS RCP supplier would be paid or would pay the difference between the rate the supplier pays for capacity in PJM and the capacity proxy price in an energy year. The EDCs again proposed to set capacity proxy prices this year to the extent that the capacity prices for an energy year are not known 5 business days prior to the start of the BGS RCP auction. The capacity prices would be trued up to the rate paid in PJM for capacity in each of the energy years proposed. There are a few additional items from the board order that I'd like to highlight here. First, the board approved updates to the SMAs related to PJM LSE requirements. There's now a requirement that suppliers must meet PJM LSE requirements and provide their PJM short names to the EDCs by May 1, 2025. Just a quick note that it has always been the case that suppliers meet PJM LSE requirements. The change is related only to the date by which suppliers must meet those requirements and provide their short names to the EDCs. Second, bidders that are not yet PJM LSEs will now be required to provide evidence with their Part 2 application that they've started the process to become qualified as a PJM LSE and that the PJM has started its review of their application materials by that time. Next, the board approved the closing or subletting of the BGS auction office during the 2022 proceeding. The board approved the EDC's proposal to continue to conduct the auctions from a place other than the physical BGS auction office. So previous protocols and procedures put in place for the remote conduct of the BGS auctions will be maintained. These include backup bidding procedures where bidders email the auction manager and a technical assistant calls the bidder back on the number provided by the bidder in its email. The auction manager will provide bidders with ample opportunity to prepare for the auctions, including holding a webcast for bidders successfully completing the Part 1 and Part 2 applications, as well as holding 2 trial auctions for registered bidders. Those occur in January and February. The next step in the regulatory proceeding is the EDC's compliance filing, which is the filing made to reflect the board's November 21st order. The compliance filing is due to the board by Thursday, December 5th, and the documents included as part of the filing will be posted and made available to bgs-auction.com. Once the documents have been reviewed and approved by the board, they become the governing documents for the BGS auctions. These include the final supplier master agreements, the final auction rules, and each EDC's company-specific addendum that include various details on cost recovery and rate design. Again, having those governing documents listed here, I will say that any statements made in this presentation or during the webcast describing or referring to the governing documents are summaries only and are qualified in their entirety by our reference here to these documents. So in this next section, I'll talk a bit about some key features of the SMAs. Aside from the EDC's responsibility for transmission, BGS suppliers will continue to have load serving and responsibility for BGS loads. BGS suppliers will be physically and financially responsible for the hour-by-hour provision of the electricity to BGS customers. The 4 requirement service will continue to include capacity, energy, ancillary services, as well as obligations to fulfill New Jersey's RPS standards, or renewable portfolio standards, or RPS, and other services that PJM may require. The structure and terms of the standard contract have been maintained from prior years. So there are 2 agreements, a BGS CIP SMA and a BGS RSCP SMA. The responsibilities under the 2 SMAs are the same, but the payment terms are different. BGS suppliers, as I mentioned, are responsible for fulfilling the obligations of New Jersey's RPS, including Class 1, Class 2, and solar requirements. Suppliers must register into GATS and be able to transfer RECs and SRECs to the EDCs while the EDCs submit the annual compliance reports on behalf of BGS suppliers. Any supplier that does not meet the RPS requirements must pay an alternate compliant payment. In addition to the information on the previous slide, suppliers are also responsible for meeting the requirements of New Jersey's Transition Incentive Program, as well as the Successor Solar Incentive Program. Suppliers do not pay for transition renewable energy credits, or TRECs, nor do they pay for SREC 2s arising from the successor solar incentive program. Instead, TREX and SR2s are retired to the applicable administrator's GATS account, and then the statewide class one requirement is reduced on a one-to-one basis. As discussed earlier in this presentation, the EDC has proposed the use of capacity proxy prices for energy year 27 and energy year 28. To the extent that the results of PJM's BRAs for the corresponding energy years are not known prior to the start of the BGS RCP auction. The BGS RCP SMA includes a mechanism for the implementation of capacity proxy prices. Specifically, the BGS RCP SMA includes supplements that detail how the supplier would be paid or would pay, the difference between the PJM rate for capacity and the capacity proxy price for each of energy year 27 and energy year 2028. Rates for customers will be adjusted by the true-up amounts resulting from the difference in the price suppliers pay for capacity and the capacity proxy prices for the two energy years. From the point of view of the supplier invoice, the true-up amounts will show separate line items for each of the energy years. We've included the capacity proxy prices that are results of the EDC's method on the slide. So for energy year 27 and energy year 28, the method results in a capacity proxy price of $270.35 per megawatt day for each of the EDCs. I'll now provide a brief overview of the credit provisions of both the BGS CIP SMA and the BGS RCP SMA. So Article 6 in both SMAs describe the creditworthiness requirements and the security required under the SMAs. For CIP, the requirements are pretty simple. The security required is a fixed amount per tranche in the amount of $70,000. There are two separate credit requirements under the BGS RCP SMA, first being the mark-to-market or MTM requirement. There is a requirement of $2.4 million per tranche at the beginning of the agreement, but that number does decline over the course of the supply period. And while there are two separate credit requirements under the BGS RCP SMA, there are also two separate lines of credit available to suppliers or its guarantor to obtain unsecured credit. The first line of credit covers the entire MTM exposure amount across all BGS RCP SMAs held by a supplier with an EDC, as well as the BGS CIP credit exposure of $70,000 per tranche. The second potential credit line is intended to address the independent credit requirement of $2.4 million per tranche. I'll end the overview of the SMAs by closing with a couple of reminders. First, focusing on the BGS RCP SMA, changes are possible during the three-year period covered by the BGS RCP SMA. Changes that I'll flag that may affect BGS RCP suppliers or that there is an annual review by the board of the EDC's rate design. There could be changes to RPS and changes to the alternative compliance payment. And finally, changes to the CIP line. That is to say, the level where customers were to take BGS would do so on a CIP tariff. The second reminder is that the SMAs filed with the board as part of the compliance filing will become, once they're approved, the standard agreements. As in prior years, during the application process, BGS suppliers must agree to the terms of the standard contract that is approved by the board, and those terms are non-negotiable. Appended to the end of the SMAs are the standard form of guarantee, as well as the standard form of letter of credit. Finally, the auction manager did hold a comment process on the BGS letters of credit. Acceptable modifications to the letters of credit are posted to the BGS auction website right now. Next, we'll talk about various key announcements that have occurred already, as well as provide a bit more detail on the BGS auction process. At this point, we've talked about the product and provisions of the BGS SMAs, so we'll give a little bit more of an overview of the aspects of the auction process now. As I briefly mentioned before, process, but two auctions. The BGS RCP auction will procure supply for residential and smaller commercial customers. Supply is procured on a rolling three-year basis, so the customers at any given point in time are served supply procured through prices determined at three different auctions. The auction determines an all-in price in cents per kilowatt hour, and suppliers are paid this price for every kilowatt hour of load served. The second auction is this BGS CIP auction to procure supply for larger commercial and industrial customers over a one-year supply period. The auction determines a CIP price in dollars per megawatt day that suppliers are paid based on the capacity obligation. suppliers are paid for energy at the real-time hourly spot price, as well as a predetermined rate for ancillary services. Suppliers are paid a CIP standby fee that is paid by all CIP customers. So customers taking in BGS CIP and those customers who were to take BGS would do so on a CIP tariff. We talked a little bit about CIP and RSTP customers, but this slide provides a little more detail on what constitutes a CIP customer versus an RSTP customer. There are certain rate classes provided in the first column that are designed or that are designated CIP customers for each of the EDCs. Some rate classes have a mix where customers over 500 kilowatts and certain rate classes are CIP customers, while customers below 500 kW may take BGS on a RSTP rate. That said, a non-residential RSTP customer can opt in to take BGS CIP provided that they notify the applicable EDC by January 4th, 2025. There are no switching restrictions to BGS customers, and they are free to come and go from BGS as long as the appropriate notice is given to the applicable EDC. Finally, we have on the BGS auction website data related to switching. This data can be found on the monthly data page. On November 15th, we announced the minimum and maximum starting prices for the BGS CIP auction and the BGS RSTP auction. For the BGS CIP auction, the minimum starting price is $800 per megawatt day, and the maximum starting price is $1,000 per megawatt day. What this means is that in the first round of the auction, the starting price for each EDC will be at minimum $800 per megawatt day and at most $1,000 per megawatt day. The other announcement made on November 15th were the tranche targets, tranche sizes, and megawatt measures that reflect the October PJM update. The tranche sizes reflect what suppliers will actually serve. So, for example, a supplier winning one ACE tranche will serve 50% of ACE's BGS CIP load. The megawatt measure that you see on the slide is provided for illustrative purposes only. The statewide load cap, or the maximum number of tranches any one supplier can win in the auction, is 16 tranches in the BGS CIP auction. We've discussed briefly, but this slide provides a bit more detail on the rates paid by BGS CIP customers and the payments made to BGS CIP suppliers. So CIP suppliers are paid for energy at the hourly real-time spot price. They're also paid an ancillary services fee, which the board approved at $6 per megawatt hour. The capacity component of CIP payment is determined through the auction price. And as mentioned before, suppliers are paid the CIP standby fee, which is 0.015 cents per kilowatt hour for all CIP customer usage at the customer meter. I'll now talk about the same announcements we made for the BGS RSTP auction. On November 15th, we announced the minimum starting price in the BGS RSTP auction to be 16.5 cents per kilowatt hour and the maximum starting price to be 20.5 cents per kilowatt hour. Like the CIP auction, the minimum and maximum starting prices for the BGS RSTP auction determine the level in which prices are set for each of the EDCs in the first round of the auction. We also announced the BGS RSTP peak load shares based on an October update from PJM. The statewide load cap for the BGS RSTP auction is 20 tranches. In addition to the statewide load cap, bidders are capped on the number of tranches that they can win for any one EDC. This is what we call an EDC load cap. Like the BGS CIP auction, a tranche is a fixed percentage of an EDC's BGS RSTP load, and the megawatt measures provided here in this table are illustrative only. As we mentioned before, the BGS RSTP auction determines an all-in price in cents per kilowatt hour. For simplicity in this example, say that the price resulting from the 2025 auction is 10 cents per kWh. The supplier would be paid the 10 cents per kWh times a seasonal payment factor, which is 1.0284 in our example here. In practice, the provisional seasonal factors are 1, meaning that the BGS RSTP supplier would be paid the same in summer and winter months. From the point of view of the customer, the price paid is determined by the results of the current BGS RSTP auction as well as the two previous auctions. So beginning June 1, 2025, BGS RSTP customers will be will pay a seasonally adjusted price determined by the auction price for the 2025 auction, the 2024 auction, and the 2023 auction. For any given rate class, tranche-weighted price is multiplied by a factor that looks at how a rate class compares to the overall tranche-weighted average. The BGS auctions reflect a multi-product design. So what that means is that both auction supply is procured for all EDCs at once so that each auction has four products, where a product is the BGS load for a given EDC. Consistent with prior years, the auction format is proposed as a descending clock auction, which occurs over multiple rounds and where supply is procured for all EDCs at once. Over several rounds, bidders submit bids and receive information regarding those bids, and then bidders have an opportunity to bid again at a lower price in a subsequent round as prices tick down. Bidding stops in a given auction when the prices for all four EDCs have stopped ticking down. The price determined through the BGS RSCP auction is expressed in cents per kilowatt hour, and the price determined through the BGS CIP auction is expressed in dollars per megawatt day. As we mentioned before, the board has accepted to render a decision on the results of the auctions within 2 business days of the close of the last auction. The board does, however, have the ability to consider the results of each auction at different times. So the results of the BGS CIP auction and the results of the RSCP auction are considered separately, but in their entirety. So what I mean by this is that the board may accept the results of the BGS RSCP auction, but reject the results of the BGS CIP auction or vice versa. That said, within a given auction, the board either approves the results for all EDCs or for no EDCs. And with that, I will pass the presentation to Rachel to continue.
Thanks, Paul. In this next section, I'll review the auction timeline going forward and then provide some useful information about the BGS auction website, as well as greater detail on the application requirements to participate in the auctions. And then I'll provide some information on the auction rules pertaining to bidding and the auctions. And then I'll pass things back to Paul to wrap up today's presentation. All right, I'll start here by highlighting some key upcoming events. First, it's important to note that the process for applying to participate in the auctions is a 2-step process in which applicants submit a Part 1 application followed by a Part 2 application. The Part 1 application became available today, and Part 1 application materials are due by noon, 12 p.m. on December 17th. The auction manager will then notify applicants who have completed all requirements of the Part 1 application that they are now qualified bidders, and that they may submit a Part 2 application, which is due by January 15th. Qualified bidders that complete all requirements of the Part 2 application will become registered bidders. Registered bidders will be able to participate in 2 trial auctions to allow bidders multiple opportunities to practice submitting bids using the auction software. The first set of trial auctions is scheduled to occur on January 30th. The second set will be held on February 4th. The actual auctions will then begin on Friday, February 7th for CIEP bidders and Monday, February 10th for RSCP bidders. Some additional important dates to note here, the auction manager will provide bidders with the starting prices for the BGS CIEP auction on February 4th and the starting prices for the RSCP auction on February 5th. The auction manager will also provide the final decrements on January 28th, the tranche fees on the 29th, and the final seasonal factors, and post the final rate spreadsheets on January 30th. I'll next offer some information surrounding the BGS website and application site. The BGS auction website serves as a central source of information for bidders. Information is organized by page. Pages are grouped together under different tabs. The Bidder Info tab houses the pages that contain the auction rules as well as the supplier master agreements. Bidders should also refer to the contract and credit page that's also located under the Bidder Info tab to find the standard form of the pre-auction letters of credit, as well as other credit documents that may be required as part of a bidder's application to participate in the auctions. Bidders access both the Part 1 and Part 2 applications on the application website, and that is bgs-application.com. Bidders will need to activate their account prior to accessing the online application forms. Bidders who have already requested an account and bidders that participated in previous BGS auctions should have received an email today containing information needed to activate their account that will then be used to access the online applications. If you did not receive the email today, or if you believe you should have received it and you haven't, please contact us. Send us an email at bgs-auction@nira.com. If you're a new bidder or if you're in need of an account, you can request one by clicking on Register for an Account under the Contact Us tab of the BGS Auction website. After clicking the link to request an account, applicants will be prompted to provide their name, company, an email address, and phone number. The auction manager will then ensure that you receive an email. It'll come from info@bgs-application.com containing information about activating your account to then be able to access the online forms. I'll also point out here that you can easily navigate to the BGS application website by clicking the orange application box on the BGS auction website. After activating your account and logging into the BGS application site, you'll be able to click on the Edit button to begin completing the online Part 1 application. And in this next section, I'll review some of the requirements of both the Part 1 and Part 2 applications. The applications are each submitted using separate online forms. Applicants should fill in the online forms and complete and upload any required supporting documents as needed. Some of the documents you'll be required to provide with the application forms are called inserts, and these are separate Microsoft Word files. I'll provide additional information on how to complete different types of inserts later in this presentation. This slide provides an overview of the Part 1 application requirements and list some of the information you'll need to provide in the online Part 1 form. The first four sections of the form collect contact information for the bidder and a number of representatives. Here, a bidder will be asked to designate a bidder team that will consist of an authorized representative as well as additional nominees. And these individuals are authorized to act on behalf of the applicant and they'll be copied on all correspondence from the auction manager. In these first sections, the bidder will also name a legal representative in New Jersey. This can be an entity or an individual who accepts service of process on the applicant's behalf. Additionally, the bidder will name a credit representative who may answer any questions about the applicant's financial information. BGS suppliers are required to be or to become load-serving entities in PJM, and in Section 5 of the Part 1 application, bidders who are not already load-serving entities will need to certify that nothing impedes their ability to becoming one before the start of the supply period. As Paul mentioned earlier, bidders who do not meet PJM LSE requirements at the time of submitting the Part 1 application will be required to provide with the Part 2 application evidence that the bidder has since become a PJM LSE or evidence the bidder has submitted all required documents to PJM in order to satisfy PJM LSE requirements and that PJM has begun its review of said documents. Again, this only applies to bidders who do not yet meet PJM LSE requirements at the time of submitting the Part 1 application. In the Part 1 application, you'll also need to provide financial information and supporting documents for the applicant, as well as for a guarantor, if you intend to rely on the financial standing of a guarantor. This includes financial statements and credit ratings, and this information will be used to determine a creditworthiness assessment for the bidder, and in turn, also determines what a bidder will need to provide as pre-auction security with its Part 2 application. The last few sections of the Part 1 application will require the bidder to indicate whether it's applying to participate in the RSCP or CIEP auction or in both auctions. And then the bidder will be required to make a number of certifications agreeing to the auction rules and to the terms of the supplier master agreements. As I mentioned earlier, the form will prompt you to provide a number of inserts. Again, these are Microsoft Word documents that will require a signature. These files are available on the application process page under the bidder info tab of the BGS auction website. Bidders should download and complete the inserts that correspond to the auction in which that bidder is applying to participate. Note that all bidders, regardless of which auction you're applying for, will need to download the zip file containing inserts 1 through 5. So if you're applying to participate in only the RSCP auction, for example, you should download the zip file containing inserts 1 through 5 and also the zip file containing inserts 6 to 8. Inserts may be signed and completed in a number of ways, and each insert will include additional instructions for its completion just at the top of the insert itself. Some inserts may be completed with a digital signature, while others may be completed using an electronic signature. What we mean by a digital signature is a signature that is created using a commercially available software such as DocuSign that generates an additional document or information that can be used to verify the identity of the signatory. A digital signature is different from an electronic signature, and what we mean by electronic is a signature that is not created using a software that generates additional information that can be used to verify the identity of the signatory. So an image or picture of a signature is an example of what we would consider an electronic signature. Each insert will fall into one of two categories based on the acceptable types of signatures that can be used to complete that insert. Inserts such as the authorized representative insert can either be signed with the signature notarized, or this insert can be completed using a digital signature. And in this case, the bidder must also provide the accompanying documentation or information that can be used to verify the identity of the signatory. Also note that if you complete an insert using a digital signature, then the insert is not required to be notarized. To submit an insert completed in either of these ways, you can upload the insert to the online application form, or you can email the insert to the auction manager at bgs-auction@nira.com. Inserts such as the nominee insert can be completed in 3 different ways. You can complete the insert with a digital signature and provide the additional information to verify the identity of the signatory. In this case, you can either upload the insert to the online form or email the insert to the auction manager. You can also complete the insert with a scanned wet signature, or you can complete the insert using an electronic signature. If you complete the insert using an electronic signature or a scanned wet signature, the insert must be emailed to the auction manager, either by the signatory or with the signatory on copy. There are instructions again at the top of each insert that describe the acceptable methods of completion for that particular insert. And I'll point out here that it is completely acceptable to complete all required inserts using digital signatures. This slide illustrates generally how the form functions. You'll see the application form includes text boxes, clickable radio buttons that, depending on your answer, will trigger additional sections of the form to appear. You can save the form as you go and then log out to finish it at a later time. But when you're ready for the auction manager to review your application, you'll hit the submit button. And once you've submitted the form, you should receive an email confirming the form was received. You'll also be temporarily locked out of your account while the auction manager reviews the submitted information. The auction manager will provide a notice with a review of the application materials by 6 p.m. on the same day that the form is submitted if the form is received by 12 p.m. that day. If the form was submitted after 12 p.m., a notice is provided by 12 p.m. on the following business day. And these notices are sent to the bidder team, again, that's the authorized representative and any nominees. If the application materials are complete, the bidder team will receive a notice confirming that no other information regarding the Part 1 application is required of the bidder. But if the auction manager requires clarification and the materials are found to be deficient, the auction manager will send a notice requiring a response from the bidder to cure the deficiencies by either 12 p.m. on the Part 1 deadline or 6 p.m. on the next business day, whichever comes later. If a bidder's Part 1 application is deemed complete, the bidder will receive a notification of qualification, and this will contain the creditworthiness assessment and provide instructions for the required pre-auction security that's due with a bidder's Part 2 application. Only bidders that receive a notification of qualification will be able to submit a Part 2 application. The Part 2 application is completed online, and it will become accessible after the window to submit the Part 1 materials closes. The Part 2 application functions similarly to the Part 1 application, with enterable fields for text and upload spots for any required supporting documentation. In the Part 2 application, bidders will need to confirm the contact information for the authorized representative and also confirm the auctions in which the bidder is applying to participate. For each auction in which the bidder intends to participate, the bidder will need to provide an indicative offer, provide the information needed to prepare the supplier master agreements, as well as make some additional certifications regarding compliance with the association and confidential information rules. Bidders will also need to provide pre-auction security. Note that the pre-auction security must be sent electronically by email to the auction manager at bgs-auction@nira.com, and hard copies of any pre-auction security should not be sent. Lastly, again, bidders who at the time of submitting the Part 1 application did not meet PJM LSE requirements will be required to provide evidence that the bidder has since met PJM LSE requirements, or provide evidence that the bidder has submitted any required documents to PJM for meeting PJM LSE requirements, and that PJM has begun its review of these documents. Here I'll give a bit more information about the indicative offer. This is the maximum number of tranches that the bidder is willing to bid across all four EDCs at the minimum starting price, and the maximum number of tranches a bidder is willing to bid across all four EDCs at the maximum starting price. For each auction, the indicative offer at the maximum starting price determines the maximum number of tranches that the bidder can bid in that auction. The indicative offer also determines the amount of pre-auction security that a bidder must submit with its Part 2 application. In addition to providing an indicative offer, RSCP bidders will also need to provide a preliminary interest in each EDC at the minimum and maximum starting prices. These values are provided for each EDC separately, and they're purely informative. Also, it should be noted that CIEP bidders must submit an indicative offer at the maximum starting price of at least 2 tranches. Pre-auction security is provided for each auction separately, such that bidders applying to participate in both the RSCP and CIP auctions must submit pre-auction security for each auction. Again, pre-auction security should only be sent by email to the auction manager. For BGS CIEP bidders, the pre-auction security is a letter of credit or bid bond in an amount of $375,000 per tranche of that bidder's indicative offer at the maximum starting price. BGS RSCP bidders are also required to provide a letter of credit or bid bond as pre-auction security, but in an amount equal to $500,000 per tranche of that bidder's indicative offer at the maximum starting price. Additionally, the results of an RSCP bidder's creditworthiness assessment may state that the bidder is required to provide additional pre-auction security if, one, that bidder is relying on the financial standing of a guarantor, in which case the bidder will be required to provide a letter of intent to provide a guarantee, or two, if the bidder does not have sufficient unsecured credit, in which case the bidder will be required to provide a letter of reference from a bank. And again, this credit assessment is provided with the bidder's notification of qualification. The pre-auction letter of credit for each auction must be in the standard form of the pre-auction letter of credit for that auction, but bidders can incorporate a number of changes and modifications to the letters of credit that have been deemed acceptable by the EDCs on an optional basis. The standard forms of the pre-auction letters of credit, as well as the list of acceptable modifications, is available on the contract and credit page of the BGS auction website under the bidder info tab. Just to note that the terms of the RSCP and CIEP pre-auction letters of credit, they are the same, but each one references the corresponding auction rules and supplier master agreements, so you must use the letter of credit that corresponds to the auction in which you're applying to participate. And just like with the Part 1 application, once you submit the Part 2 application, you should receive an email confirming receipt of the submission, and you'll be temporarily locked out of your account. The auction manager will send a notice either stating the Part 2 materials are complete or that the materials are deficient. The response time for bidders responding to a deficiency notice for the Part 2 application is the same as for the Part 1 application, except for pre-auction security. The pre-auction security is reviewed by the auction manager and a committee of representatives of the EDCs, and the review may be provided in a separate notice to a bidder and not necessarily at the same time as the notice provided to a bidder about the other Part 2 materials. Before handing the reins back over to Paul, I'll just provide you with some information on the auction rules as they pertain to submitting bids in the auctions. As Paul mentioned, the BGS auctions themselves, they proceed in a multi-round process. And for a given auction, a bid in round one is simply the number of tranches for each EDC that the bidder is willing to supply. In the example you see here, the bidder is willing to supply 10 tranches to PSE&G, 4 to JCP&L, 2 to ACE, and 1 tranche to RICO. I'll note here that a bid is only an offer for supply and that bidders do not specify a price in their bid. Instead, the price for each EDC in a given round is stated by the auction manager. There are two important rules surrounding your bid in round one of a given auction. The first is you will not be able to bid in excess of your initial eligibility. And your initial eligibility is determined by the amount of pre-auction security provided as part of the Part 2 application. This is also equal to your indicative offer at the maximum starting price for a given auction. The initial eligibility will apply to the total number of tranches you may bid across all 44 EDCs in round one of an auction. The second rule deals with load caps, and notably in the BGS RSCP auction, you will not be able to bid above a certain EDC specific load cap or above the aggregate statewide load cap. For the BGS CIEP auction, there will only be an aggregate statewide load cap, so not EDC specific load caps. And this aggregate load cap will serve as the maximum number of tranches available to be bid across the 4 EDCs. After bidders submit their bids, the auction moves into the calculating phase, where the auction manager tabulates the results of the round. After the calculating phase, the auction moves into the reporting phase, and this is when bidders are provided with general information about the results of the round, as well as some information on their own bid for that round. In the reporting phase, bidders are provided with a range of total excess supply. The total excess supply is the sum of all offers for supply in excess of the aggregate tranche target across all 4 EDCs. So in our example, in the table you see here, the actual value of total excess supply falls somewhere between 81 and 85 tranches inclusively. The range of excess supply at the start of the auction is narrow. In our example, the range provided has a width of 5 tranches, but as we approach the end of the auction, the width of the range of excess supply or total excess supply rather will become larger. Bidders will also be provided with the next round's price for each EDC, and bidders will be provided with some information about their own bid from that round. It's important to note that a bidder will only receive information about its own bid and will not receive information about another bidder's bid or about another bidder's identity or eligibility in the auction. From one round to the next, the price associated with a particular EDC will only tick down when the total number of tranches bid on that EDC in a given round is greater than the tranche target for that EDC. The amount by which a price ticks down for an EDC is relatively large at the start of the auction and then becomes relatively small toward the end of the auction. The relationships determining the rate at which the prices decrease from round to round are called the decrements. There are three regimes that govern the price decrements. The auction starts in regime one, then once certain criteria have been met, the auction progresses into regime two, and then towards the end of the auction enters regime three. This slide lists the ranges of decrement percentages that apply to each regime. Final decrement formulas are made available in, I believe, late January. It's following the registration of bidders. The bid in round one is relatively simple. and that a bidder provides a quantity of tranches it is willing to supply to each EDC at the prices stated by the auction manager. Beginning in round two, there are effectively four actions a bidder can take when submitting its bid. First, the bidder can elect to maintain the same bid it provided in round one. A bidder could also decide to withdraw tranches from the auction by reducing the number of tranches it bids across the EDCs. The bidder could switch, which means the bidder reduces the number of tranches bid for one or more EDCs while increasing the number of tranches bid for one or more EDCs. Or the bidder could do both, withdraw and switch at the same time. However, a bidder can only request to reduce the number of tranches bid for an EDC, either by withdrawing or switching, if the price for that EDC has ticked down. Now, I mentioned there are rules that dictate the total number of tranches a bidder can bid in a round. In round one, remember that a bidder can bid up to its initial eligibility. In round two, the total number of tranches a bidder can bid across all EDCs cannot exceed the total number of tranches the bidder bid in round one. This pattern carries through for each subsequent round, where the eligibility in a round is equal to the total number of tranches bid in a prior round, the immediate prior round. And just like in round one, the statewide load caps for each auction and the EDC-specific load caps in the RSCP auction are still applicable. On the next few slides, I'll provide some examples of actions a bidder can take beginning in round two. On this slide, you see an example from the perspective of the RSCP auction, where a bidder is withdrawing one tranche. In round one, the bidder bid a total of 15 tranches across all four EDCs. And now in round two, the bidder is bidding a total of 14 tranches across all four EDCs. Specifically, the bidder bids the same number of tranches it did in round one for PSE&G, JCP&L, and RICO, but it is reducing the number of tranches it's bidding on ACE from 3 to 2. When a bidder elects to withdraw tranches, they'll be required to name an exit price, and this will serve as the bidder's best and final offer for the tranches or for the tranche being removed for that EDC. An exit price must be greater than the current round's going price, but must be less than or equal to the previous round's going price. So in our example here, the exit price must be greater than 17.73 cents per kilowatt hour, but less than or equal to the previous round's going price of 18 cents per kilowatt hour. And you can see that the chosen exit price of 17.85 cents per kilowatt hour is within this range. A bidder is also able to switch, which means the bidder reduces the number of tranches bid from one or more EDCs while increasing the number of tranches bid on one or more EDCs. In the example here, from the perspective of the CIEP auction, we can tell that the bidder is switching and not withdrawing tranches because the total number of tranches the bidder bid across the EDCs in round one, which is 10, is maintained in round two. However, we see that the allocation of tranches across all four EDCs differs from round one to round two. The bidder removes 6 tranches from JCP&L and transfers 4 to PSE&G and 2 to ACE. When a bidder reduces the number of tranches bid on one or more EDCs and increases the number of tranches bid on more than one EDC, the bidder must provide a switching priority. The switching priority is used in the event that some of the tranches being transferred out of one or more EDCs, in this example, JCP&L, are retained by the auction manager in order to ensure the tranche target remains filled. So we can see here that the bidder assigns a switching priority of 1 to PSE&G, which means that tranches are first allocated to PSE&G before being allocated to ACE in the event that some of the tranches removed from JCP&L must be retained in order to meet JCP&L's tranche target. Now, the last example we'll review today is when a bidder withdraws and switches at the same time. We can see this happening in the example here because the total number of tranches bid between round one and two decreases from 9 to 8, and because the allocation of tranches across the EDCs between rounds one and two also changes. Specifically, we see the bidder is reducing, again, the number of tranches bid in total from 9 down to 8, We also see the bidders reducing the number of tranches on JCP&L and RICO. And we see that the bidder is increasing the number of tranches bid on PSE&G and ACE. But what we can't tell is whether the one tranche being withdrawn is being withdrawn from JCP&L or from RICO. In this case, the bidder will be asked to designate which tranche is the tranche being withdrawn. And in this example, the bidder withdraws the tranche from JCP&L and provides an exit price for this tranche. It's important to note that there are certain circumstances when a bidder's request to switch may be denied or when a bidder's withdrawn tranches may be retained. Generally, a switch may be denied and or a withdrawn tranche may be retained if the tranches switched or withdrawn are needed to fill the tranche target for the EDC from which the tranches are being switched or withdrawn. The auction manager first fills an EDC's tranche target with tranches bid at the going price. If the number of tranches bid at the going price for that EDC is insufficient to fill the tranche target, the auction manager next fills the target by retaining withdrawn tranches. And if that's still not sufficient to fill the tranche target, the auction manager will then deny switches. When provided information about a bidder's own bid during the reporting phase, bidders will receive information regarding any retained withdrawn tranches, including the exit price at which tranches were retained, as well as information regarding any denied switches, including the last price at which the tranche associated with the denied switch was freely bid. And a reminder here, a bidder will only have access to information about its own bid and will not have access to information about another bidder's bid. We looked at a few examples of what a bidder can bid in round two. And the rules for bidding in rounds 3, 4, 5, and so on are the same as bidding in round two. Now the auction will continue when there's excess supply for at least one EDC. The auction ends when total excess supply equals zero and prices for all EDCs no longer tick down. Bidding on all EDCs will stop at the same time, and all bidders that win tranches for an EDC will get the same price. And with that, I'll pass things back to Paul to wrap up today's presentation.
All right, thank you, Rachel. In this last section, we will go through the bidding procedures for the 2025 BGS auctions. Bids are submitted online using the auction software. You will be able to access the auction software using a specific login ID and password provided by the auction manager after successfully completing the Part 2 application process. Bidders will have multiple opportunities to practice submitting bids using the auction software, including via two trial auctions. The two trial auctions will be held on January 30th and February 4th, 2025. We encourage bidders to participate in the trial auctions from the place where the bidder will be bidding during the actual auctions in order to test the functionality of the technology used during bidding. That said, the system requirements are minimal and include a standard computer and a supported internet browser. The BGS CIP auction, as we've said before, will begin on Friday, February 7th, with the BGS RSCP auction starting one business day later on Monday, February 10th. While the auctions do run on different days, it is possible for them to run concurrently to the extent that the BGS CIP auction extends beyond Friday. Tentative auction schedules will be provided to bidders with the January webcast, with final auction schedules to be provided the business day prior to the applicable auction. There are several pauses that can occur during the auctions, two types that are initiated by bidders. Bidders will have the two available extensions that extend the bidding phase of a round by 15 minutes. These are typically used in the event of technical issues where you would be able to contact the auction manager for troubleshooting or to place a backup bid. Note that the bidding phase of round one is automatically extended by the auction software. In the event a bidder does not request an extension in round one or does not submit a bid during the bidding phase of round one, an extension will be charged to that bidder and run concurrently with the auction extension, the automatic extension. Bidders also have one recess request typically used to consider their bids. This will only be available after round 10 and when certain criteria are met regarding excess supply remaining in an auction. Lastly, the auction manager can call timeout, for example, in the case of general technical problems, and we will communicate with you if this happens. This concludes the presentation portion of today's webcast.